Well, hello there. Oh, I've got lots of letters for Santa today. And every year, they're the same. Some ask for toys, but a lot ask questions.
A yo-yo?
If you wish to give me a present?
I'd like to be a dentist.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back again to the Christmas Specials We Love podcast. Kevin here with Anne, Elaine, Kelsey, and of course, our dear friend Christian Blatt. Tonight, we're going to discuss the Seinfeld episode that aired during Thanksgiving. Of course, it wasn't an actual Thanksgiving episode, but it took place on Thanksgiving Eve. It was the Thursday before Thanksgiving, I believe. Well, actually, the Thursday before the Thursday of Thanksgiving that this aired. Very interesting episode. And then in bonus, we're going to talk a little bit about the Macy's Parade, a little history behind that, what happens to those floats. If you're a fan of our podcast, you know we covered the Friends Thanksgiving where the underdog float and the Macy's Parade figured prominently into that episode. It does in this episode as well. So with that, I'm going to open it up to the panel with some general thoughts on this episode. Christian, I'll start with you.
In true Seinfeld fashion, of course, the show that doesn't do hugs or special episodes, it's not a Thanksgiving episode. There just happens to be an event that happens on Thanksgiving, but it's more about party. It's not about Thanksgiving. It's the fact that Jerry wasn't invited to PA, Bryan Cranston's party. That's a very Seinfeld thing. It's not about the holiday. They don't care if they're, I don't think any of these characters would be disappointed if they were sitting home alone on Thanksgiving Day. But they're like, oh, we're going to go to the party beforehand and Jerry's not invited. And it really becomes that. And it's about John Voight's car. It's about Jerry's sneakers. There's so much more to it. And it's a very appropriate holiday episode, I think, for the show. And I actually forgot that this one had anything to do with Thanksgiving. When I looked up what the episode was, I remember John Voight. I remember a lot of these things at the mom and pop shop. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess that party is on Thanksgiving. So I was excited to have an excuse to watch it. Not excited about the way that Netflix decides to format old style box, letterbox style shows. And they just stretch out the image. Didn't look as good as it could have. Other than that, it was fun to revisit the
episode. Oh, great. I didn't even know that. I just bought this. We watched on Apple. Wow. And what were your thoughts?
I agree with what Christian just said. And I had to keep checking back. I'm like, wait, the mom and pop store, that's Thanksgiving? Because my memory of it wasn't that there was anything to do with Thanksgiving. And then when in further research, I was like, oh, this is Thanksgiving, but Seinfeld doesn't do it. But yeah, I like Seinfeld. This is classic George Costanza, classic Kramer. I think this is one of the funniest episodes in Seinfeld history. So
really?
I'm really excited to talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Good to hear. All right, Kelsey.
I love this episode. I like Seinfeld a lot. I love Elaine in this episode. I think she is really good in this episode. And I like how much, I feel like she usually does. They give her a lot of time and lines and stuff typically. But I thought that her character in this episode, just what she did and what happened was hilarious. So I really enjoyed it. But yeah, it's definitely not a Thanksgiving episode, which is also hilarious. When I was Googling it, trying to find a Thanksgiving episode, people were like, they don't really have one, but I guess this one kind of works. But I really enjoyed it. It was, like you guys said, it was a good excuse to watch it.
Elaine, what do you think from Gen Z?
I didn't really watch Seinfeld versus the Friends episode that we did. I watch Friends a lot, but Seinfeld I never really watched. So I'm learning about these characters 6 seasons in. But I do love Elaine, not just because we have the same name, but she really holds up her own against all these guys, and she's funniest. She's over there picking off little salt for her boss. We're like, wow, you go, girl. And she's like singing along, having a great time. And she's going along when she lost her hearing at some point. And like,
so would you keep watching this show? Would you keep watching, Elaine?
I think I like Friends more just because they do tug on your heartstring a little bit more. Like you're saying, Seinfeld is more like just a comedy show. But Friends, it tugs on my heartstring, and I love those shows that just really makes it feel like you're watching a family and it's like a community of this.
That's why I think it's an apple and an orange, because there's with Seinfeld, it's just pure comedy. For me, I really loved it. The fact that there was literally nothing to be thankful for, it was hilarious. What I really miss is the irreverence, and I don't see in a lot of live action comedy anymore. Just a lot of nonsense and just things where you could tell it was Larry David or someone at the head who was like, why not just do it? things that you wouldn't see in some of these other shows because they're so structured and they're so formulaic. All the different left turns and nuances were so fun and refreshing. And I guess I'd have to think long and hard to where what show today would show me that. I see it in Rick and Morty. I see it in cartoons. But to see it with actors, it was refreshing. And I have to say, and I said this in our last episode, when I think of I Love Lucy as the leader of classic sitcoms and everything followed them, I think in the next era of sitcoms, this is the I Love Lucy. This is the classic that set the tone for everything else. And when I think of a foursome and think of Fred, Ethel, Lucy, and Ricky, and I think of this foursome, I don't really know any other stronger group. The Will and Grace group was very strong too. But the fact that you guys love Elaine and she was hilarious and then Kramer was hilarious and George was hilarious and Jerry's almost the Ricky Ricardo. He's also very funny too. But I don't know a stronger foursome.
I would say the Cramdons and the Nortons, because that was like the first time where the women were be just as funny.
You're right. Like I forgot. I said last episode. Yeah.
But apart from those, I can't think of anybody. And it was one of the things we were talking about Friends was all of the characters can get good jokes at any moment. And there are very specific styles of jokes for each of these characters on Friends. And Kramer is the most stereotypical sitcom character, comes in and is wacky, but still was so groundbreaking in that what he said and did had never been on TV before. But he's from a mold of characters that you had before. He's like the Lenny and Squiggy, as soon as he comes in, it changes the dynamic. It's why I think that the Seinfeld finale is a little bit underrated, because it just reinforces these are all really bad people. You spent a decade watching them, but they're not likable. They don't have redeeming qualities. They didn't learn anything, but you can have fun and laugh with them.
I bet you they'll revisit that episode. Critics will revisit that episode later and they'll look more fondly upon it because it was clever. It didn't have the big finish, as you saw, to quote Amadeus, when Salieri's advising Mozart on how to do something mainstream. You must give an audience a big finish.
How many seasons did Seinfeld have?
10. This one is entitled The Mom and Pop Store. But before we get into that in production notes, I want to say thank you to so many people who've already given us a 5-star rating and your comments. Next week, we'll start reading some of them back to you. But please, if you haven't already done so, can you go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, give us a 5-star rating and a great review. And yeah, we'll start reading them as more come in. Also, if you have specials you want us to cover or just comments or questions in general, you can text us.
351-251-2511. That text number again is 351-251-2511.
Or go to the Christmas specials we love, and you can text us or send us your comments, questions, etc. from there. And give us a little background on this episode, if you will. I know we don't have a lot because, again, it wasn't the Thanksgiving special. It was just one of many great episodes.
Thanksgiving special that wasn't a Thanksgiving special. In true Seinfeld form, as we said. Like you said, this is the Mom and Pop Store, Seinfeld Season 6, Episode 8. We're basically halfway through the Seinfeld series here with our 94th episode. Vulture ranked this one of all 180 episodes, number 15. I think it's one of the funniest ones, like I said, too. One thing to point out in production notes, this was when we were first introduced to Bryan Cranston. His character, Tim Watley, who's here and was in 4 other episodes, so 5 total, The Label Maker, The Jimmy, the Strike, and of course, this, the debut, The Mom and Pop Store. Pretty fun episode to discuss.
I did a little due diligence I was like, well, I wonder how John Voight feels about this, because he has a cameo appearance in it. Very rare, by the way, for a movie star to appear in one of these things, but you can tell Seinfeld was so hot at the time. And again, it seems that he's super grateful now in hindsight, looking back, that he did it. But I wanted to see what his thoughts or feelings were on this now. I was able to pull an interview, and the interviewer was asking about an upcoming film, and they're talking about the film and said what was cool. The interviewer slipped this question in. Everyone wants to know, did you really own a Chrysler LeBaron convertible? A certain Seinfeld episode says you did. Here's John Voight's response. You know what's funny about that? My mother owned a Chrysler Baron. She lived in Florida at the time. And she said, John, if you're going to do that show, you get them to buy the car from me, which I didn't have the guts to ask them, but they probably would have done it. You know, they would have done it. They built the script out of an experience that the writer had where he had bought a car because it was sold to him as John Voight's car that had a pencil in it, which turned out to be a doctor named John Voight. And it wasn't me. It was all part of the script. When I came to the set, the writer said, John, could you do me a favor and walk around the corner with me? I want to show you something. We walked around the corner at Warner Brothers backlot and he showed me a LeBaron and said, did you ever own this car? And I said, no, I never did. And he was let down. So the whole thing was that they had this experience of being sold this car, which they thought was mine. It was very charming. The whole experience gave us a memorable episode of Simon.
That's so cool.
How about that, Darnold?
That's so funny. And Kev, you could probably speak to this as a writer, but I didn't realize until I started reading up more on The Office, like how many of these experiences truly come from the writer's lives. That's so crazy.
Oh my goodness. You remember the episode of Friends where Rachel wanted to become a smoker because she noticed on smoke breaks, the other employees were bonding with the boss and getting ahead in business. So she had to pick up smoking and jump out there with them to bond. That 100% happened in being a writer. I can't tell you time smoke break and all the smokers go out and they're talking about jokes and they're all bonding and you're sitting behind. Yes, so much of it is autobiographical material.
Yeah, you're sitting behind being one of the squares who doesn't smoke. You're one of the kids. The writers that actually happened for, I was reading this in Anne's show notes, Tom Gamble and Max Prost, who anybody who really knows comedy, they were on a season of The Mail and Gary Shandling Show. There's so much in the credits. I love the fact that it really happened to them. It was like one of them didn't believe that the other one really did have John Voight's car. And it turned out he was right. It wasn't really John Voight's car. And I think that that's a great thing about science. George trying to quit the Yankees and then coming back. Or I think it was before he worked for the Yankees. George quitting his job and then coming back on Monday because he realized he didn't want to quit. That really happened to Larry David. He worked on Saturday Night Live for a season and he hated the idea that he should stay there all night and write. He would just wanted to go home. He's no, I'm done. I already wrote my jokes. I wrote my sketches. I'm done. And he didn't need to stay up there all night and rewrite. So at one point he quit, but then he realized what a huge opportunity that was. So Larry David came back in on the following Monday and was just like, no, I was just joking. And he did stay on the rest of the season. He said he legitimately quit, but then realized. And the Seinfeld staff, they would bring new people in a few times throughout the run of the show. And usually they were people who lived in New York. So they were like, what's new in New York? What's going on? Oh, in one instance, it was not sure. I think Steve Corin wrote this episode. It was one of those, oh, there's a guy that we call the soup Nazi. Oh, tell us about that. So that's how they would get some of these ideas. There were things that were happening because most of them, they all lived in LA by this point. So they didn't really know what was going on in New York. So a new writer would come and bring new stories. And I think that helped keep it as fresh as it did. I know, Kevin, you've talked about how Jerry felt like they had done it.
Well, it wasn't Jerry, but the writings, to be clear, I talked about this last episode, but being in the writer's world at that time, we knew a lot of the writers on staff and they wouldn't let in new writers. They were and anything you pitched them, no, we got it. No,
yeah,
we're going to do this. No, that's not going to work. They became the smartest people in the room. So they blocked a lot of new ideas and new energy coming in. So by when Larry David left, you could see they started losing orbit slowly but surely without him. And then by season 10, Jerry was like, we're out of ideas. This is so stressful to do this. And they used to be there till 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning. Sometimes they wouldn't even go home. They'd work right into the next day. And that's usually a sign where a show's not either being managed right or is out of gas. To us as outsiders, it was because they were not letting new people in. We're Seinfeld writers and the rest of you are over there. And when you get like that, with any business, by the way, you're not growing. We start with the stand-up and he does a joke about, he's joking about cars. He says, a LeBaron is not owned by a LeBaron. And a Subaru Impreza is not that impressive. But I want to ask you, Christian, there was a time where the opening joke would relate to the episode, but then didn't they get away from that? Or is it the other way around?
I think it got too hard for Jerry. I think sometimes Jerry probably did come up with it, but they were probably written for him, some of these bits. And I think that at a certain point, it was like, it would be maybe tangentially connected to the story, but a lot of times the stand-up bit. And I can't remember, did they keep doing the stand-up bit all the way through the end of the series? Because
I think so.
It didn't stick with me as much later on. But I think it was too hard to have it actually be tied in. So I do remember it just being a little bit more of an afterthought and probably just a joke that Jerry saw. I have a show. I'll put this out there.
It was fun at first to see because it established him as a stand-up, but I think it was something they didn't necessarily need. But then it became the show, right? So it was part of the show. Yeah, and what did you, the stand-up thing?
For the stand-up thing, what I found out was that after season 7, probably because people were starting to get bored and storylines were getting hard to come by, that's when they stopped including the stand-up.
Yeah, also it's taking up from, if I'm a writer, there's so much more creative things you can do in those, that 1 minute. Or think of the opening from Friends, the teaser last week, Rachel's asking her boss for an advance so she can go away and you're a terrible waitress, and she has a joke, but it's a fun opening. If you have Jerry standing there with a mic, it's cool, but think of, as a writer, what you can do. And what started happening with these sitcoms, which is interesting, is the credit sequence. In old sitcoms, you would have music and roll the credits. The writers started realizing, wait, that's more precious real estate. We can do more creative and fun things. So you started seeing the credit sequences being really funny. I love the idea that they lost it because they were able to do more. And I remember just sometimes they would have 4 plots going at once as time went on, and the plots were very intricate. What they liked was tying them all together at the end and making them pay off. So having to do all that work, it's cumbersome to have the stand-up in the front and the end. It takes away precious time. Kelsey, what did you think of
that? I always zoned out.
You zoned out.
On the stand-up. Yeah. There was only a couple episodes I remember that I was like, oh my God, that was funny. And I realized that it related to the episode. But typically, I would just zone out.
Elaine?
I completely zoned out during the stand-up for the Thanksgiving episode. And honestly, when I watched the first few episodes of season 1, I didn't even realize that it was there. For a little bit, I was like, what's going on? And I was like, why isn't the episode starting? I was like, oh, he's talking. And I thought it was just like something that he...
I also think our ADD brains, we just need the action. We open at the used car lot, and George has his heart set on an 89 Volvo. Interesting, too, because sitcoms usually stay evergreen in the respect that they never mention a brand. They never mention a year. What ends up happening, you kind of date the show by doing this. But who knows? Maybe they got some money from Volvo because they put Volvo over. It's a Volvo. It's a great car, whatever. And the used car salesman, great actor. He really looks the part. He's, yeah, but sure, you don't want to look at the LeBaron convertible? It was owned by John Voight. And so that perks up George. I just thought from go, this was just so irreverent and so clever at the time. I don't know if the comedy today has this stuff, but this was stuff you would never see before.
The actor who played the used car salesman was so perfectly cast, Ken Thorley. Kristen, you probably know other things that he's been in, but in rewatching this, I thought he should have had more of a play because he was just so spot on perfect. He's like, oh, well, I got the 89 LeBaron over here, like a little bit sleazy.
Yeah, yeah.
It belonged to John Voight with the little sly comment. So
I know that I'm jumping a scene, but I love that immediately Jerry and Elaine are like, oh, that's why you bought it. And so the used car salesman, he's like, all right, I can't quite figure this guy out. He's so determined. I'm going to just rattle off a couple of things. And
Hail Mary.
John Voight. Yeah, the John Voight was it. It's great because it's not like A-list movie star of the day. It's John Voight. It's so funny.
Right.
Great. Yeah. That's not the point. But it's not somebody that you're going to think of right away. Just look at Midnight Cowboy. It's not Dustin Hoffman's car. It's John Voight.
Right. It's John
Voight. Right. Well, and Liam Neeson thing.
It's funny because Lucy... You would see on the original I Love Lucy, George Reeves, and she had some big names. She would call him because she was friends with everybody. She was the queen. But it was never somebody, like you said, irreverent and offbeat a la John Voight. It would have been Dustin Hoffman or somebody super mainstream. So again, that's why I love this show, and I love what this show did for comedy. We're in Jerry's apartment, and this is when we find out that the dentist, Tim Whatley, is looking for information. He wants to invite Elaine and George to his Thanksgiving Eve party, which I've never heard of, which is a cool idea for a party. This is when George appears with the new keys to his LeBaron. And it's interesting, Elaine says, wait, but he's not even known for cars. And then they start rattling off all the other movies he's been in that deal. Like Deliverance is in a canoe. And it was really funny. And again, that's what I love about this show. They just go off on that tangent. And other shows never did this.
Right. But when he says, runway, train.
Right. Yeah, they start lifting all of the things. Kramer enters, and he's upset that the neighborhood, the mom and pop stores are going away in the neighborhood because the mom and pop shoe store is soon to go out of business because the yuppies are going to come in with their cookie and coffee shops, which of course Elaine and George think is great. Kramer has the passion to, of course, keep the fabric of the neighborhood alive. And I just love he just calls them yuppies. It's so funny.
Doing that generation thing right there, like we do all the time, like the Gen Zs, the Gen Xs, the millennials. We forget about the yuppies, I think, now. But
great line from George. What's so great about mom and pop stores anyway? He's my parents would be terrible owning a store. Okay, buddy. Also cool that in contrast to Elaine and Jerry real being like, it's John Voight's car. Yeah. But notice Kramer's reaction. Boss. He thinks it's the best.
It's so cool.
Yeah, he's amazing. Kramer's off at the shoe store. He takes Jerry's sneakers because he's trying to keep the shoe store in business, drops off all the sneakers. And the lady says, why? And again, precursor to everyone with the sneaker collections today. Back then, no one had a sneaker collection.
Oh, okay.
No one. The mom of the mom and pop store questioning why. And then Kramer's answer, he's got Peter Pan syndrome, which Jerry did. But we've talked about on the show, Christians, when we did the Charlie Brown episode, we were just talking about how today's 50-year-olds, 90% of them have the Peter Pan syndrome. They're huge Star Wars fans. They're wearing their Marvel T-shirts in contrast to what it was like 30 or 40 years ago. It's interesting. Jerry was early to that world of he was a geek. He was into Superman. He was into comic books. He's got the sneaker collection. He doesn't really have the 9-to-5 job. I thought that was interesting that she pointed that out.
Yeah, I thought you always say that. You always talk about everyone in LA having Peter Pan syndrome.
Yeah.
So I would not have known what that meant, except for the fact that we've talked about it before. So then I thought it was funny.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just say what Kelsey was saying. As soon as that came up, I was like, yep, just like what we talked about. Kev pointed that out on a previous episode. And it is interesting to see that Jerry Seinfeld was one of the pioneers of admitting to the Peter Pan syndrome.
Yeah, he used to admit it, even in interviews he did.
With cereal, we had all the cereal and that. And like you said, Superman. And that was one of the first times I can remember seeing a grown man or grown male's character be that childlike and still be living in the adult world. Yeah,
Jerry is basically Tom Hanks in Big when he becomes an adult, except there was no magic in Jerry. Just was like, when he was a kid, this is what I want to grow up as. And you assume that the actual Jerry, at least at this point, before he was a multi-billionaire, and honestly, in a lot of ways, he probably still lives like this. I'm sure he has suits that he wears now, but he probably still has a lot of sneakers, and they're not even he doesn't have a closet like the Sam Roberts of the world. It's a lot of, no, these are the most comfortable shoes. I'm going to wear these more often. And yeah, so I think, what did we decide this was? 1990. So at that point, yeah, look, I liked all the stuff that Kevin was talking about, but I didn't advertise. I was a freshman in college. I didn't talk to anybody about stuff I liked when I was a kid. You know, I had the misfortune that I still read comic books at that point, but
tomorrow out. The subscription. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Today I'd be a hero, but back then it was like, wait, on Saturday you're going to a comic book store to buy all these comics? Yeah.
What about the T-shirts, though, Christian? Were you rocking those Star Wars tees back then?
No, you know what? By every once in a while, yeah, there was a certain point where, honestly, when the Star Wars movies came out and were re-released in 1997, I do remember I bought a shirt that looked, it was a new shirt, but it had the ringer on it and had the original poster for Star Wars. So it was like a throwback. And I did start wearing that even around in college at that point. But it was probably more band T-shirts is what.
But also wasn't as readily available.
Today,
you walk into a Target or Kmart, Target or Walmart and online. But back then, Newbury Comics in the New England area was a little bit of a comic book chain, so they would have those irreverent and cool T-shirts, but it's not like they were so available. Anyway, we digress.
But just as dated as Jerry getting out his phone and pulling out the antenna before he makes a call.
Oh,
it's a wireless phone. You needed the antenna or that you weren't going to be able to hear. It was going to be all staticky. So it's a lot of the shows like this and Friends, you have to remember, oh, yeah, it wasn't that different, but in a lot of little things. And yeah, the Peter Pan syndrome being a joke, whereas now a lot of people are like, hey, that's what I do.
I also think this is for any aspiring writers out there. And I always talk about this too when we're pitching things. When your main character can have a Peter Pan lifestyle due to their finances. So you see Larry David on Curb, because he's not blocked financially, he's so bored, every day is an adventure. Every day is just ridiculous nonsense. And it's a lot of fun to watch. It's certainly fun to write. But Jerry, that was that character, which made it so compelling because you knew his life was just, it was almost a permanent weekend.
It was preposterous. You know, it was completely ridiculous, which made it fun and made you almost envy him.
George and Elaine always had to have jobs, but Jerry and Kramer, there's moments where Kramer did something, but honestly, they're just really humble.
And even their jobs were ridiculous. George was the most stressful, but for the most part, Elaine whizzed through those jobs and they were entertaining and fun. And when I think of the Honeymooners, I think of the strain that Ralph Kramden was under. Even though it was a comedy, it was always painful.
He drove a bus. His best friend worked in the sewer.
What? Off jump.
They had the worst jobs in television history. Ricky Ricardo was a band leader at the hottest nightclub in the world.
Yeah, he was
not that tough.
No. And Fred was just managing the building. That was easy.
Yeah. My old boss, Dennis Miller, would talk about how the idea that Ricky and Fred were friends is he is the hottest band leader in the world, and his best friend is a 1,000-year-old janitor.
It made no sense. Kramer gets a nosebleed, and this is what's going to trigger some interesting things happening. He looks up at the ceiling. He's, you notice all those wires? This place could blow up at any minute. We have to get that fixed. Okay, so we know that's a pipe bomb that's about to go off. Now we go to Elaine.
48 years of running that store, they never looked at the ceiling. They never noticed.
But by the way, I totally bought that because
100%
people that are in those old stores. I know that there's a place in Van Nuys that repairs electric shavers, and it's been there, I think, for over 50 years. And while all the other electric shaver and repair places closed, when barbering in the last 15, 20 years made the comeback it did, they now came back to life, and it's the third generation taking over. But the store, now the third gen comes in, he's, I know, but my father and my grandfather, I want to fix the sign. But it's all completely the same that it's ever been. So I totally bought.
Yeah, never dusted.
Yeah, no.
Don't
never
look up either. If you want to hide something, hide it high, because people never look up.
And Christian, I remember there being in the towns I grew up in, a cobbler. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Miss.
Yeah. It was like a counter in the shoe store. But yes, there was somebody that you could get your shoe cobbled.
The shops. Yeah. But there were shops that back before was, I know Kelsey's in shoes, before was Disposable America. And Elaine's raising her hand too. People, that's what you would do. Yeah. I'm going to get my soles redone. Mm-hmm. I got to go down to the cobbler. And yeah, they had the setup and everything. Okay, Elaine, you got excited. You raised your hand. I would like to hear from you, Gen Z, on this.
I am lost right now. What does it even mean to cobble your shoes?
They repair your shoes. So a lot of the soles of your shoes wore out. Today, you would donate them or throw them away and go and get new ones for so cheap. Back then, they would actually replace the soles, stitch them. And the same with shoe shine people. That was an actual profession, being a shoe shiner, because guys, you know, your shoes would get all scuffed up. You'd sit in your chair and they'd give you a nice polishing, then off you'd go. And was your place, it's probably not open anymore, is it?
You know what? It was open a couple of years ago because old Mr. Pizzini was still selling shoes. I don't know how much cobbling he was doing, but he turned it into a sneaker shoe store.
He evolved.
Yeah. He evolved a little bit, Mr.
He sold out, unfortunately.
But Elaine, to your point, too, I think that's where the phrase, they're well-heeled, came from. Because back in the day when people could afford to bring their shoes to the cobbler, they got the new heels on, where people who could not, did not, and therefore they were perceived to be not as well off.
I also wonder, too, if it was like such an East Coast versus West Coast thing, or more of an East Coast thing. Because when I was 20, I worked for this woman in Boston for the summer. I was like her assistant. And I remember she was like, take my shoes to the cobbler. And I was like, what? I literally was like, Kelly, I don't know what the hell.
What did you say?
Cobbler. I literally was like.
Cobbler.
The cobbler.
Cobbler. You know, the cobbler down on the corner. It's right on that.
I was like, A, I don't know what that shit you're saying. B, I don't know what that means. And I remember I literally had to call my mom. I was like, well, you just told me to take her shoes to someplace.
Called the cobbler?
The cobbler. But right up on the West Coast, like, I never had heard of it in my life.
I think. speak against stereotype, but I think more conservative culture in terms of dress, more suits and slacks and shoes, and whereas you, but West Coast, flip-flop sandals, sneakers or tennis shoes, as they said on the West Coast. Maybe that's why. There's a mall in L.A. that had a person that does it, and it's a very small, tiny store, not really known as a cobbler, more as it said shoe sneaker repair. But now, because these sneakers are so expensive, I bet you anything, there is going to be a trade there.
There was one in the Port Authority in New York that when I was a page at NBC, I had wear dress shoes, but I worked every day. So I almost never had a chance to get them fixed or shined. And if I got a day off, I would drop them off at one at the bus station because I'd be going out to Hoboken and I come back in the morning. But they did cobble, they did shining. It was a little counter though. I can't imagine real estate at the Port Authority in New York.
Right.
And this is still a long time ago, but this is in the late 90s and it was still there. It was still there at least into the 2000s. I doubt it's there now, but there is more demand for having fancy shiny shoes in New York, to Kevin's point, just because people have jobs where you're expected. I swear in California, it's like you can show up and look interesting. That'll be fun.
Okay. Elaine's in her office listening to jazz, which we'll learn is Artie Shaw. She's removing salt off of pretzels. Now, I felt like this definitely shows the time period. Can you imagine a millennial or Gen Z being asked to remove salt off pretzels?
Yeah, I can, because I'd do shit like that.
Okay. Okay. Here's the thing now, Kelsey. Let's preface it before you make me sound foolish.
I said, old boss.
No, not me.
No.
You tell me any of your friends.
Absolutely not.
You literally work for one of the most rotten people, one of the most psychotic, whatever. And I know we work for many people, so you're not going to be able to find out who it is.
But no, anyone.
But you got blueberries thrown at your head, and the person you work for was borderline psychotic.
Yeah. But no, any of my friends would be like, excuse me, what?
And then forget Elaine's generation.
Yes.
If I ever said to Elaine's generation, yes, I need you.
Take the salt.
We had interns at AfterBuzz. Part of what we all do at AfterBuzz, myself included, the founder of the network, because we did so many shows, we all worked over there together. So we would spray Windex down on the tables and wipe them down. You, Christian, you remember in between shows.
Of course.
And everyone lent a hand and I'd be doing it. The staff would do it. And I remember one time an intern was just asked to do that. And we take at AfterBuzz, the messaging there, half of our mission is to help talent, educate talent, and certainly down to the interns. And we take it very serious. We had professors, teachers call us and complain, and we were like, no, wait, what? Excuse me? What about the fact that I was like, I had to talk to my staff. Tell me about this person's day. Greeted this major celebrity, about to sit with the celebrity, then pulled this person aside. Taught them how to write a press release, which no college, I put the professor on the spot. Do you know how to write? Well, we do that. Really? Can you tell me how a press release opens? Crickets. I'm like, no, I know for a fact no film school teaches that. We take what we do here very seriously. And I said, guys, from now on, do not even ask them. God forbid. Kelsey, sorry. You are very unique at your tolerance level. And we've discussed that. Right?
Yes.
But you know your friends would never.
No way, no.
And maybe the older millennials would, but this new generation, no freaking way.
And I don't know anyone who would.
Well, it was obviously, but I bet you, anyway, I bet you some writer experience. I've known people have to separate them for certain colors. I've seen it all.
When I was an intern, I did Max Weinberg's Christmas shopping. Not really. I was an intern at Conan O'Brien. He was a band leader. I think I was at the Virgin Megastore in Times Square for 4 hours just looking for it. Had nothing to do with my job. When I was an intern at Saturday Night Live, one of the other interns had to leave the after party and go home and get, let's just say, a high ranking female producer's birth control device from her apartment.
So darn, don't look good.
And these are stories I can say while we're recording. But this is just the tip of an iceberg.
Here's the thing. None of it was right. And I'm glad that it's been vanquished. But this is why I ask the younger generation to have empathy for some of us, because this is the world we grew up in. And myself and Christian know better than to ask someone to do that. But no, that's what we've experienced. So think of all the other things we were taught were normal that now is not. So that's why I always say to the young generation, I'm willing to adapt and learn, but you have to be willing to teach us, and you have to be patient, because you're unraveling 50 years of the abuse and torture and programming that we went through, and the three of us have chosen not to let it roll downhill, but you see a lot of people do.
Yeah, you hold us to 2022 standards because we have picked the proverbial salt off the pretzel. You know.
Yes, we okay. We learned that there's a radio contest. By the way, a radio contest. People still have them. I know Ryan Seacrest, Ryan's Roses. People still participate in these.
Yeah,
but it was much bigger than that.
Usually, it's a radio show that airs in 8 markets, and in all 9 cities, people are trying to win the same $3,000. And the person who wins doesn't say where they. You never really have a chance. But this is, I had the same thought, Kevin. I was just like, oh my God, I remember calling into a radio station for a ticket.
I used to all the time
growing up. Yeah. With good old Ryan, yep.
Mr. Pitt, the boss, finds out there's a sweepstakes to be able to hold the rope for the Woodpecker balloon. And so he engages Elaine to now participate in the contest so he can win. And she hears Next Stop Pottersville, which is a famous song, I think, recorded in 1939.
Why wasn't it in the show notes, though?
Sliding Mr. Bones by Malcolm Lockyer.
It's actually not a real song. They just thought the name was funny. The one that she wins with right now.
Next Stop Pottersville is not the real song. It's actually the Sliding Mr. Bones.
Wow. And now pop culture has so much power. Now it is known as Next Stop Pottersville. I was wondering if it was a callback to It's a Wonderful Life, where fictional Pottersville arises when George is presumably not born. And I thought that it was one of the songs, jazzy, fun songs playing when they had that montage when George visits Potterville, but I was not correct.
Now, I had a similar fleeting thought when they were talking about that in Mr. Pitt's office, too, and then he did the little dance to it, and I'm like, it doesn't make sense to do the happy dance and be a reference to Pottersville. And then I tried to find some info and it didn't seem to have any connection. But I had the same exact thought, Kev.
But I love, again, the irreverent random writing. Again, I've been in these writer's rooms with the showrunners and the executives who would say, no one's going to know. Why John Boyd? Why? And I just love that at some point, Jerry and Larry David proved their point and just said, get out of our way. Just let us do this. And now what's nice about the Netflix is the Hulus, you're seeing more artists be able to do that. Now, they're saying, we let them do what they want. We give limited notes. That's why it's great to be here. The truth of the matter is they do that, but they don't do it for the reasons they think. They do it because they don't have the manpower or people power that the networks have. The networks have so many people who have to stay employed. I don't stay employed by saying, oh, great job. I stay employed by going, we need to change this, tweak that, adjust this. And it's really difficult. That's why you see network TV is such a struggle versus streaming or cable. But they don't have the personnel in those places. They just move things along. And then they say it's because, oh, we support the artists. But really, they don't have the people power to be able to do it. But it works out. I think it works out most of the time in favor. I've seen it go the other way, too, where the artist gets too much power. And then you've got something too long or too boring or too. So it's a trick. Funny thing, but in this case, seeing this episode just reminded me how much I know that Suits and executives would have said no to 80% of the jokes, 80% of the plots. And just, it was just Larry David going, nope. And them going, okay, we get at season 6. They were just, whatever he said was gospel, which was obviously the right thing.
Which is perfect because Mr. Pitt's character, I think, is one of the greatest third tier characters in any comedy. I think he is absolutely hysterical and just strange. And
he's overshadowed by Letterman later in the series. Not about Mr. Pitt. And I'm like, oh my God, he was a great character.
So I forgot him too. I totally forgot him because of Mr. Peter. And by the way, the actor who plays that, I know Maria my wife used to host, and probably still does actually, the Purina Dog Show with him.
How fun.
He gets in the suit.
John O'Hurley.
John O'Hurley. He's such a presence.
And you always think he's Peterman, even at the dog show.
No, yeah. But again, he can cash checks the rest of his life just off that one role. Same as the suit Nazi. Go ahead, Kelsey.
I was going to say, I liked about this scene, again, calling back to the progressive nature of this show and Friends, is how much power they gave Elaine in that scene. And it was like, he immediately turns to her and is, okay, let's go. And when he's rushing her to guess, she's stop. And he backs off because he knows he needs her. And I love that because I feel like even today, there's no way. Like, if I don't know, it's just like he was like, okay, you're right. I need you to win this. So I'm not going to press you. And she freaks out for a minute and it's like, oh, I don't know.
Elaine was as much of a victim as all four of them would be at different times. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, she walked her own beat.
She did. Yeah. But I was like, I like that.
All right. We got Jerry and George walking. And this is where the reference to Liam Neeson comes up. If he said Liam Neeson, you wouldn't believe him. And then there's a couple of Liam Neeson jokes that come about. I just thought that was really funny.
Also, so random.
Random.
Funny. Liam Neeson, what? What a random A-lister, quote unquote, to choose. I loved it.
Jerry needs clean shoes, he realizes, because he steps in something and George doesn't want that in his car, of course.
Gum.
George is singing the song from Midnight Cowboy. It's a famous song in that montage where John Voight is walking to that 70s song, which I got it. The title now escapes me.
Everybody's talking at me.
Yeah. Everyone's talking at me. Iconic
Neil.
Montage and hit song. Jerry finds out his sneakers are gone and Kramer enters. No sneakers, but he left boots behind for Jerry. And Jerry has boots from a Texas club owner who paid it in boots. This is where I think Jerry's really underrated as a comedic performer, because that, I don't want to be a cowboy, I thought was hilarious.
When it referred back to season 5, episode 2 with the puppy shirt, when Jerry's, I don't want to be a pirate. So they were playing that same theme.
On a show that did a ton of callbacks, but they knew when it was the right moment. Obviously, I don't want to be a cowboy. It was great. It had been a while, too. It wasn't like last week he had just said it.
Right.
It was great.
I feel like it ties into that Peter Pan syndrome too, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a kid. I'm fine.
This is where Kramer was impressed by the John Voight LeBaron, which I still just warms my heart. We cut to the shoe store. The electrician breaks the bad news. We're going to have to report this and the store is going to close. Then we go to George and Jerry and the LeBaron. We see the pencil. We see the owner's manual and that we learn John Voight is spelled with an H, but we do have the pencil with some teeth marks in it. Jerry thinks it's all funny that George more than likely did not buy this car for the John Voight he thinks he did. And George kicks him out of the car. Again, where they just didn't care. You have references to Liam Neeson and John Voight, but now even in his jokes, he's, oh, there's Gregory Peck's bike. There's Barbara Mandrell's skateboard. Stuff that I would have to think Elaine and Kelsey, Barbara Mandrell.
I know who Gregory Peck is, but just because I love To Kill a Mockingbird, but I do not know who the other people are.
All these people besides Liam Neeson just went right over my head.
And again,
like, I was like, who
cares, right? You don't know. But this is where I'm sure Larry David's like, I don't care. Play through.
Yeah, you know, like, the joke didn't need to be for everybody. You know,
right.
And I think that your more mainstream sitcoms maybe felt like they needed to. And it was just like, no, it makes us laugh. Let's say Barbara Mandrell instead of saying us Morissette or something.
Trying a lot of historical references and pop culture. And yeah, so it speaks to different generations throughout the whole show, which is the last point film.
But the fearlessness of it, because when someone probably said to him, that's not going to hold up, he was probably like, who cares? But what's interesting, he went with iconic characters that, if anything would hold up, I would think Gregory Peck and maybe Barbara Mandrell's really a reach. But I know she is. I'm sure Christian and Nan do as well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, from the Mandrell sisters.
Yes.
She's like the working man's Crystal Gale. I just said that to make you laugh, Kevin.
You nailed it.
She was...
Oh, yeah. Jerry's chased off by some thugs in boots. Then we go to the apartment. George is in his suit and realizes he's got the Yankee organization at his disposal. And this is how we can find out if the actor John Voight owned this car. And meanwhile, Elaine talked to Tim Watley and got her invite. Jerry wants a callback of the conversation. Why would Jerry bring anything? Did he emphasize would or bring?
That was such a good line. So clever.
Kramer enters. Mom and Pop have vanished. This is, to me, this is my favorite part of this episode. Jerry's sneakers are gone. And then Kramer finds out that they didn't have any kids, that they're not a mom and pop at all. So Jerry and Kramer feel like they've cracked this case. And this is my favorite point where Elaine goes, wait. So they waited 48 years just to steal Jerry's sneakers. And then
the community loved them.
And the idiot guys are like,
yeah, apparently.
Elaine leaves to get her Macy's pass to be able to hold the Woody Woodpecker balloon. And we get to George at the Yankees office where he says, we need more event days, like Joe Pepitone, who's an old Yankee player, or John Voight Day. And then the owner, the boss, says, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have any more of these George Costanza meetings.
And then he makes that, if it was Liam Neeson, I'm sure you guys would do it.
Yeah, great callback.
Yeah, man.
Okay, so now Elaine's at a venue where the big band is playing with all these big band fan nerds who are throwing all these factoids about bands that are just ridiculous, and she's stuck with them. And then the music just cranks right in her ear. Now, Jerry over at Jerry's at the apartment. He chipped a tooth, but he doesn't have a dentist because it's Thanksgiving. He debates going to the party. George, of course, says, no, I'm going to the party without you. I'm not going to ruin my pass to the party. Kramer reports in about John Voight and the teeth marks. Do they match the pencil? But I always love when George and Kramer work together. The two knuckleheads come together with their schemes. And of course, we understand when we go over to the dentist, someone there is going to be able to figure it out.
Kev, one thing I wanted to point out, that scene where John Voight took a bite of Kramer's arm, according to producer Andy Ackerman, John Voight didn't let anybody know that he was actually going to do that. So Kramer's resistance and reaction, which he's one of the best physical comedians anyways, but that was legit real, which I think adds to the fun of that whole scene.
Oh, that's so funny.
And John Voight and Christian, correct me if I'm wrong, he seems method. He seems like that actor. He's very, you don't know which way he's going to go. There's certain actors that you just don't know what they're going to pull out. And it's part of their brilliance, but it can be a little scary too. I could totally see him.
Yeah, I would. You want Voight in the metal prize. It was probably in the script that Kramer was going to get bit, but I feel like John Voight actually bit him.
And yeah,
that's what he didn't expect. Because the teeth mark is such an important part of the plot. But I think John, I have had occasion to talk to him on the phone a few times. I think he's actually a funnier guy than people. You don't really think of him that way. And I think he was just like, this is going to be a good moment. He was probably excited to be like, wait, this big show wants me to be on. It's not like he was at a low point in his career, but it was also like, oh, that's fun. It's not what I usually get to
do. It's fine. I remember when I had a friend who worked for Mad About You, and Marlon Brando left a message for Paul Reiser of the Star. And he was like, Mr. Reiser, I really like your show, and I would like to be on at some point in time. And it didn't end up happening. But what you usually find with a lot of the film actors, when they come onto these sets, which especially as four-camera sitcom is usually very structured. There's usually not a lot of room for improv at all. And if they improv, they're doing it in rehearsal, and the director goes, ooh, I like that. Put that in. But when these guys come on set, because they're used to improv, but also they're used to having a certain degree of power, and to your point, Christian, they're coming on just to have a good time. So I'm sure I'm John Voight. I'll bite his arm. Because I've heard of so many of the film stars, when they come onto these sets, that's what they do. They improv, they do what they want, they come up with ideas.
Funny.
God, there's so many that I wish I had that I could reference, and none are coming to mind, unfortunately. But I always knew what they call it, stunt casting in Hollywood, when they bring in a big name star in another place that they know is going to make a splash, hence calling it a stunt. But yeah, when they come in, oftentimes it ends up being a lot of fun. Oh, I think it was Yoko Ono when she did. I think maybe it was Mad About You, but she came in with a lot of great ideas that they were like, yep, all right, let's do it. It was one of the shows she guested on, but she came in and she totally had all the ideas, and they were like, yeah, we'll do it.
Friends obviously did that a lot. They had an after the Super Bowl episode that had a lot of Jean-Claude Van Damme and Brooke Shields and people that didn't necessarily make sense, but they wanted to get people to watch. But then they would also, because they were friends, there's the episode where Billy Crystal and Robin Williams come into the coffee shop, and it was just because they had a movie together to promote. It has nothing to do with anything, but it's also probably one of the funniest cold opens in the history of the series, because it's just, you can watch the actors just watching the two of them work. So yeah, it's great when you have like star that doesn't need to be a guest on this show.
Yeah.
Brought on.
Right.
And I had no idea about Yoko Ono being on Mad About You or whatever.
It was one of those shows.
I'm going to need to see that. I'd need to see her coming into a sitcom, because I was in an elevator.
Someone told me she ended up naked. I think it was Naked in Bed at the end, redoing what she did.
Oh, that's funny.
She was Rob Lenda, I think.
Yeah.
But now watch, we're going to research and I'm going to be totally wrong, and you're going to see why I'm middle-aged with my brain.
She was actually.
I just pulled that up, and it is Mad About You in 1995.
Yep.
So good call.
So there's a shot of Snoopy, and then we go to Dr. Tim's party where we get to see a young Brian, and then we see a shot of the Woody Woodpecker balloon being pulled down the street, the giant balloon. And again, irreverent comedy. Problem with Woody Woodpecker, yeah, he's an instigator. He's a troublemaker, which I thought was funny.
Very.
And if you knew the Woody Woodpecker character, you would know that about the cartoon. Elaine and Kelsey, have you ever seen Woody Woodpecker?
Nope. I know who he is, but I've never seen him. But I know who he is.
Yeah.
Too. So he must have been a big guy. Oh, no, they talk about Underdog.
They talk about Underdog. You're confusing.
And I'm just confused now about the...
old character.
Yeah.
It's funny because on the set of Entertainment Tonight, they used to take my wife Maria's laugh that, hey, and they brought in the Woody Woodpecker and they did a mix where it was, eh, and then it was Maria's. And they every time Maria would screw up on set, it would come in over the speaker. And it was really funny.
Woody Woodpecker, the one that runs really fast and his feet just looks like circles.
No, that's Roadrunner.
I thought you had it.
Woody was cool. Woody was almost the bird version of Bugs Bunny in the respect he was a smart ass and he always came out on top. If I recall, Christian, am I right?
100%. Yeah, I was actually going to say the same thing. I was like, just think of him as Bugs Bunny because he filled that role. Really annoying though. That laugh. Oof.
Yeah.
Well, it's annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Piercing.
Okay. Elaine comes in. She can't hear because of all the band music. You guys are laughing about that, which I think is great. And Dr. Tim asks her out. She says no because she really can't hear him.
He's so butthurt.
He's really hurt.
Really sad.
And if you knew about her love life on the show, probably not good for her to not have connected with Dr. Tim. But George and Kramer talking to a female dentist and they're trying to get information of the bite mark on the pencil. That's when Dr. Tim enters and reveals that John Voight is actually a periodontist. And he's like, oh, my friend's LeBaron. Yeah, John, you know, the same time Woody Woodpecker pops. And we see Mr. Pitt struggling with the deflating Woody Woodpecker. And he's a troublemaker. Callback that Woody Woodpecker is a troublemaker. And then Jerry does a little bit of the laugh, which I thought was funny. Okay, another slight stunt cast because we cut to Jerry getting a call about his sneakers. Some nerd has gone out and bought his sneakers. The nerd's actually played by Dan Furshman, who you may recall starred in Head of the Class, another forgotten sitcom starring the great Les Nessman.
Oh,
Howard Hessman.
Howard Hessman in the first few seasons.
Howard Hessman.
Billy Connolly.
Yeah. And then Billy Connolly.
Les Nessman from WKRP. Yeah. If you're doing Thanksgiving show.
I know. Yeah. I was going to say, at some point, we have to do a WKRP in Cincinnati Thanksgiving special. One of the major publications ranked it as number one, the greatest
of all time. By the way.
Really? Okay. See, that's now two things, Christian, you're making us
do. The whole thing builds up to a payoff at the end of the episode. The whole thing, it's all set up really for an amazing payoff of it.
Okay. So, is Alf Thanksgiving? And we'll be doing.
Well, Alf is a Christmas.
Oh, Alf Christmas.
Alf is Christmas.
Yeah. Sorry. Yep. And that's WKRP Thanksgiving.
On it.
But interesting, Jerry heads off to get his sneakers, and then Kramer's in the car. His nose bleeds, and then the music from Midnight Cowboy comes in, and they parallel and mirror the scene from the movie, which is dark and very cool. A little noir, but I thought was amazing. Kelsey, did you know that was a callback to the...
No, I knew it was a callback to something by the way they were acting in the back of the bus, but I didn't know what it was specifically to. So I was doing one of those, clever,
yep.
But I didn't know what it was actually more about.
And did you know?
Yeah, it was actually a callback to Dustin Hoffman in that movie, Riding the Bus. Yeah.
With John Voight.
With John Voight. When they kept referring to Liam Neeson in the show, I thought it was interesting when I saw that ending that Dustin Hoffman wasn't the star that they referred to just to keep the Midnight Cowboy theme together. But obviously, Liam Neeson worked, but I thought it
was... I think Liam Neeson's funnier because you could have a Dustin Hoffman day.
And he was definitely
potentially.
This was the same year as Schindler's List. That's why there's a joke.
Right.
Schindler's List.
Yeah. But it's also more irreverent for a Liam Neeson day to be suggested. A Dustin Hoffman day, nobody at that time was bigger.
No. And then in 2022, a Dustin Hoffman day would be very problematic.
Yeah, it's very sad. You guys, listen, once again, I didn't realize this would go so long. Thank you for
all I'll say about that, by the way, is what I love about Seinfeld is that's the end of the episode. But yes. If they didn't feel like they needed to be like, hey, is it too weird to end with a parody of Midnight Cowboy? And Jerry and Larry are like, nah, that's the end.
And they didn't play the song. Like the music was playing. I think Kev mentioned that, which was
perfect. Yeah. And then Jerry talking about the marching band in his stand-up. At the end, like over the credits. Yeah, whatever is right. So I really enjoyed it. It reminded me how much I loved this series and appreciate it. I don't know if it necessarily got me in the spirit of Thanksgiving like Friends did.
True.
But we wanted to deliver this time in television, this must-see TV Thursday night block that was so big. now 30 years ago almost, which is crazy.
God, it came out the year I was born.
Yeah. And like we had said in the last episode, this episode aired the same time as that first season of Friends Thanksgiving episode. So the one we covered on that was November 17th in 94. So it was fun to talk about both of those.
Yeah, a little bit. Once again, we just go back in time on the Christmas Specials We Love podcast. You guys, if you like this, yeah, and you have comments for us or even questions or suggestions about specials you want us to cover, I remind you to text us at 229-447-268, 229-447-2682. And if that's hard to remember, 229-44-SANTA, 229-44-SANTA. Also, christmasspecialswelove.com podcast. You can contact us there. Maybe most importantly, besides going to the cobbler, go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating and your comments. Leave your comment, which as the weeks go on and more come in, we will be reading to you. And I guess that's it. The march to the holidays continues. We'll be bringing you many more specials. Didn't have time to get to our discussion about the Macy's Parade, but I think there's a mini-sode in this fivesome that we'll release at some point in time. Needless to say, hopefully you guys are putting up your trees early, or at the very least, you're preparing your Thanksgiving. By the way, for Thanksgiving, that seems like a week leading up for gathering supplies and things and getting the pies and the turkeys, or is that a few weeks out?
Depends on the size of the crowd. True.
Yeah.
We don't have family close to us, so we always just did it, the four of us, and it was our tradition was to go on a hike in the morning and then go get donuts and coffee, and that was it was very cool and chill, and we were always sad we didn't have family, and then all of our friends who had a ton of family were always like, no, you're lucky you don't have family, because they had to do all the crazy prep.
Yeah, it's a lot. It ends up, my wife, it just got to a point where she was literally making herself sick. She works full time, and I would say, just stop, we're fine. But for me, the prep is the most fun. Yeah, you're having some wine, you're making things, you're laughing. It's the anticipation. I used to teach people that too. When we throw mixers and parties at AfterBuzz, I would tell the kids, listen, oftentimes the setup and the breakdown is the most fun, because you're anticipating and you're excited, music's playing. And then the breakdown is all the gossip of what happened at the party. And so I would say, think of the school play if you're ever part of that. But it was always the making the sets and things like that were the most fun. And then afterwards, oh my God, I can't believe this. I can't believe that, more so than the actual event. And so that's one of the things I like about Thanksgiving. And also Thanksgiving Eve is the busiest party night of the year for a reason. And I also know some friends who used to do touch football. And then as they got old, they aged out, they do horseshoes the Thanksgiving morning. Oh. So they're playing horseshoes in the morning. But a lot of people will go to their town's Thanksgiving game, yep. I think is interesting. So, right? Do you do
that? We have Apple Cup, yeah. Washington State versus the University of Washington.
But that's a college game.
That's college.
And that's on Thanksgiving?
And it's Thanksgiving.
So you don't do any your high school?
No, not high school.
Christian, what about you?
My high school was so small, it actually didn't have a football team. My graduating class was 63 people, and that's two towns put together. We had a soccer team in Greenwood Lake, New York. It's right where the suburbs start to get rural. 45 miles northwest from Manhattan, near the Woodbury Common Outlet Malls or the Round. That's really all we've got. Yeah, but in terms of my prep, the big thing that I was in charge of, since I've lived out here with my wife, her family lives out here, I was in charge of getting the honey-baked ham. And I only made a mistake one year, and I went the day before Thanksgiving.
No amateur hour. Oh, yeah.
What did I know? My mom used to cook a ham, and they said you can get it on Monday, and it's going to, I'm like, can I get it on Sunday? So I would sit in our whole fridge. Yeah.
Yeah. But, or you pre-order. You just walk in with your number. By the way, shout out to Honey Baked Ham, because I've done that a couple of times and it's JFF. It's just freaking fine. I've
so said good.
My wife so many times, you don't have to kill yourself. Because it was a couple of years where I got the hot tag. I'm like, I got it. And a lot of the stuff I went out and just bought.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we were fine and no one knew the difference. And what about you? What was like Thanksgiving memories, Thanksgiving?
Yeah. So my mom was a nurse and she had to work one of the holidays. So she usually chose to work Thanksgiving growing up so she could have Christmas off. So a lot of we would hit the high school football game, and then my dad, not knowing what to do with kids, we would rake the entire yard.
Classic.
I'm going to take you on some more of the classic boomer dad meets Catholic culture.
Unbelievable.
Get it?
You know it, Jeff. Yep.
Oh, my God.
Classically, we would forget to do the one instruction that my mom left for us, turn the turkey on at whatever time. And so she'd get all upset with us. And then my dad would be like, ah, geez.
Oh, that's how we, Kelsey, if you knew how we grew up, you'd be horrified.
We did too.
Yeah, you. But that's why we get along so well, because you're a throwback. That's why you got blueberries thrown at your head. That's what you worked for all the wackos, because they licked their chops when they got you. They're like,
true.
This girl's not a millennial. No, this one is Gen X. We can terrorize her.
God.
Elaine, what about you? I know you're a single mom in Taiwan, so you didn't come here to...
So we didn't really do Thanksgiving. I think we tried one year, but since there were two of us, the turkey just sounds so extreme. How are two women, small women, going to eat a giant turkey? So we got a little roast rotisserie chicken from Costco, I think our very first year, and just really tried to do that. At least just try to incorporate it a little bit. And then we're just like, you know what, whatever. We're going to stick with our Chinese food on a Thursday.
I like the Chinese food as well.
Me too.
It's as long as we're doing something.
We're going to Mexican this year.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
All right.
We already decided. Because one year, the last time, I hardly ever go home for Thanksgiving. And I'm going home this year. The last time I was home, I made an all vegan dinner and they wanted to kill.
Oh, yeah.
They were so pissed. And I
loved
it. Yeah. Oh, just can I? Okay. This is.
I'm not vegan.
This might be off topic for Christmas We Love podcast, but I'm going to say this anyway. Okay. When it comes to traditional Thanksgiving dinners,
mm-hmm.
and especially when you have company, and Cassie, hopefully you'll be able to fill in the blank. Don't
improvise. But Emily.
Yes.
I'm going to take this away from you. Whether it's okay. You make with Maria, I'm like, you make your traditional stuffing. Don't
improvise
stuffing with walnuts and cranberries and olives. And oh, but I saw that, but this is a buffalo chicken stuffing. I'm like, Maria, don't improvise. Most people wait all year. How often do you have stuffing? How often do you have those dishes? So you wait all year for this. Now, if you want to improvise, that's a secondary dish. You
right.
improvise. We can have an alt table. And you can have all your things that we'll test in beta. We'll have all those dishes out. And listen, it's almost like the McRib. Just something right. you bring out every now and again. We see if people take to it.
Same.
And that's it. You mentioned you liked your cotton candy blizzard.
Yeah.
They don't seasonally would somehow would appear on the menu at Dairy Queen, but then often it doesn't. So I'm just saying that to the fans of the Christmas We Love podcast. Don't
improvise.
Thank you. Just. Okay, unless you're just cooking for yourself.
Right.
All outside the lines, all you want. Other than that, don't improvise.
You're right.
And if you want to improvise, alt table.
Once is traditional stuffing. No.
No, not everyone. Right. Think about consumer behavior. Most people, you're waiting all year and you're excited. And like, I know people like, oh my God, I'm not eating. I'm saving room. I'm excited for this, that. And then you like, wait, what is this? How many times I've seen this? And so Maria knows by now. She's like, oh my God, you're so right. Don't improvise. You can have an alt table and your alt dishes. Okay.
My wife's family, Chinese American. And the first Thanksgiving I went, it was perfect because they had what I like to call white people Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
In addition to white people Thanksgiving, they had sticky rice. They had dumplings. There were wontons. My wife makes the wontons now.
I'm all in.
And I love all the other stuff.
All in.
And for whatever reason, somebody in the family always showed up with a bucket of Church's chicken, fried chicken. That was there too.
Great.
I don't know what that was about, but I was just like, great. It's a little bit of everything. But yeah, you have to get the essentials.
Yeah.
Yes.
But okay. But if you don't have the essentials and you're going to just say, we're going Mexican this year, Chinese, I'm fine with that. I just don't want to show up to a Thanksgiving dinner and the traditional ones. And then they start messing around with the recipes. Yes. But I will say I do that with what your Chinese in-laws do. I will say as an Italian, I do. So I always make sure there's an Italian section, especially over Christmas and Christmas Eve. And now Violetta, who's our house mom, she's Guatemalan. So her family does the Mexican-American, but now I've made it Mexican-American and I send them Italian. And now they're all in on it. Oh, yeah, I love that. By the way, it's just all about pigging out, but...
It is. We're going to Hawaii. We'll be in Hawaii for the second year in a row. And we do a very Hawaiian Thanksgiving. So we all collaborated and came up with what that was. So we get the purple Okinawa sweet potatoes, which are amazing if you've never had those. And we get some big fish and wrap it in banana leaves and cook that up. And
can I offer this to your sweet potatoes?
Yeah.
A little tahini drizzle. On the purple sweet potato.
And again, having that on the side. That is your option.
That's an option. That's on the alt table.
Put it on the side.
It's on the alt table. Everybody, listen, all joking aside, if we could try to remember what the day's about, which is being thankful, being grateful. The fact that we do have lives where this is, we're even able to do this podcast to talk about fictional things for this much time. But right. I think that's the main thing, is try to remember what the day is about. And thanks for still tuning in as we continue to go to OT. What a surprise. But I think for now, we'll say goodbye, and we'll be back with more specials to cover, more important discussions. And as you prepare for Thanksgiving, don't
improvise.